morning and welcome to the second day of the October term of the South Dakota Supreme Court of the Judges of Mount Martin College and Chamber. As you entered, you may have noticed that we have certain publications available in the lobby. If you did not pick them up, this is your first expose during break. We are designed to tell you a little bit more about how our system works in South Dakota. The light blue cover is a case summary of all the cases that we'll be hearing oral argument on this term, including the ones this morning. It also gives you short biographies of the justices. The second book we have, a light gray covered book, is a pictorial history of the Supreme Court of South Dakota, recently updated. You can also find this informative. And the final book, the blue covered book, is a written narrative of how our judicial system works in this state. We would like to welcome this morning students from Sacred Heart High School, Freeman High School, Menno High School, Dakota Christian High School, Montrose High School, Scotland High School, Irene County High School, Freiburg High School, Hardington High School, Avon High School, Yankton High School, Elgin High School, Unified School District Number 1, Niall Barra High School, Bonesfield Fairfax High School, Rock Valley Community School, Clearwater High School, Early Green High School, Washington High School, Wausau High School, Ewing High School, Clarkson High School. We are often asked about decisions we made, and we now have them available within a day or two additions on the internet. And if you are interested in engaging in your argument on this morning, and read in the newspaper or hear in the media that a decision has been subsequently issued, that is available on our website, which is on the back page of the booklet dealing with the case summaries. Also available there would be a recording of the oral arguments this morning if you wish to review a portion of the argument. With that, the first case this morning is Welch versus Klein. For the appellant, Welch is Mr. George F. Johnson, an attorney from Gregory, South Dakota. And for the appellee's Haas is Mr. Jack Beeler, an attorney from Mitchell. Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir.
Your Honor, and please the court, counsel. I know that the facts of this case have been briefed in detail, but I feel that they're so important that I want to just spend a little bit of my time talking about them this morning before I get into the actual argument. This is obviously a case about a keg party that occurred back in May of 2000. It happened about 40 miles outside of Winter. At that party, there was a lot of kids there, a lot of beer there, and there was parents there who were apparently there to supervise and make sure that nobody got hurt and nobody drove drunk. In the wee hour mornings of that party, after the kids had been up all night, one of the kids, Darby Klein, who was a defendant to this action, got access to his keys somehow. He got his minivan, they loaded it full of beer cans and a keg of beer and a bottle of rum and five passengers, and they drove it to the gate of the farm. At that gate stood Zenda Hazy. She's also a defendant in this action, and she was charged with protecting that gate. She had voluntarily assumed that duty to make sure nobody left that party. What she did was she asked Darby Klein to make a phone call to his mother to get permission to leave. Darby Klein did make that phone call, but being 40 miles outside of Winter, the line was staticky, and we don't know what was said and what was heard. Anyway, after she got off the phone, she allowed Darby Klein to drive out on the road and make the 40-mile trek back to Winter. What she didn't do was she didn't check in any respect whether he was sober, whether he was tired, having been up all night, and whether he was safe to drive. Had she checked, she would have found that he was drunk. He had a 0.18 blood alcohol level. That's an estimate from our expert that testified at trial. She would have found all the beer in the vehicle had she bothered to look in there. She would have found that if she had asked, that he had slept little or none. So
how far did the accident occur after they left the gate?
Several miles down the road, John.
How many several?
I believe it was about 5 minutes after they left the scene.
So didn't consume any more beer or alcoholic beverages after they left?
There's some factual dispute about that, Your Honor. I believe that one of the witnesses testified that they did have some Go cups when they left. Now, I don't know if one of those Go cups belonged to the driver, Darby Klein, or one of the passengers, or both, or, but there is, I believe that they were consuming alcohol as they left, after they left. And in fact, the testimony was that they were not going home, they were actually going to go to another party, even though it was 7 in the morning. So they make it a couple miles down the road, having not checked them and letting them go out on the road, and they wreck. The car flips, and it lands upside down. My client, Kaz Welch, is trapped in the vehicle. The chair has actually got him pinned to the roof of the car because it's on its top, and it's suffocating him. The kids kick the windows out, and they try as best they can to get him out. He is conscious. He's responding to their commands to squeeze his hand. They're looking at him. They're talking to him. They're trying everything they can to get him out. They cannot get him out, and eventually, looking in the eyes of one of his friends, he lets out his last gasp for air. We sued, claiming, one, that Darby Klein was negligent, two, claiming that his mother negligently entrusted the vehicle to him, three, that Erla and Allen, that the Hazzies, the landowners, had done things that were negligent and had breached duties by allowing him to get his keys and allowing him to leave the farm while intoxicated with the carload of kids. Important to note in that respect that two of those defendants, the Kleins, both defaulted. Neither of them submitted an answer, and the judge ruled that they had admitted all of our allegations as far as liability. That would mean not only that they admitted fault, but all the causation issues as well. So?
Did you sue for a specific amount in the complaint?
No, sir, we did not. We sued for what would be reasonable and fair.
So what did you prove up as far as the damages were concerned?
We submitted evidence, strong evidence, I believe, and undisputed evidence, Your Honor, that it was a wrongful death by offering the testimony of the grandfather and the mother, who both submitted a great deal of evidence about how they missed my client's companionship, his society, and all the things that you can recover for under the wrongful death statute. We further submitted evidence that he suffered personal injuries when he suffocated during that time before he died. And there's a dispute about how long he was actually alive suffering there, but it's undisputed that he suffered personal injuries before he died, and we submitted that evidence.
Did you make a motion to the court for judgment notwithstanding the verdict then after the judgment in relation to the damages against Darby Klein and his mother?
No, Your Honor, not with regard to the damages. We just made a general judgment notwithstanding the verdict for all four defendants, arguing that it was an unfair and unfounded decision, and we came forward with about three different arguments why we thought that. Okay, where was I? Two of the defendants, I said two of them defaulted and admitted liability. Two of the defendants presented numerous arguments, defenses about contributory negligence and assumption of the risk, and we had a four-day trial. The jury came back and did the unthinkable and found for all four defendants, and it awarded zero damages. We quickly moved for a JNOV, or alternatively, a motion for new trial.
Was this a general verdict, or were there any special interrogatories?
There were some special interrogatories, Your Honor, but they didn't get that far, apparently. There was four basic verdict forms. One for the plaintiff against all four defendants, one for the plaintiff. One for the Hazzies against the plaintiff. one for the Kleins against the plaintiff, and one for all four defendants. If they found for the plaintiff on the first verdict form, then there were special interrogatories that would go towards the contribution issue of all four defendants and try to figure out who was most at fault.
So in essence, you have a general verdict?
Yes.
Okay. Did you object to the general verdict form that was submitted?
Your Honor, I honestly and truly believe that I had, but in reviewing the transcript, it appears that I did not. And so I did submit my own verdict forms, but they were not accepted by the court.
So that's not before us on appeal?
No, sir. At the motions hearing, where I was asking for a new trial, I argued to the judge that the decision was fundamentally unfair for three reasons. One, I argued that the jury may have been confused by the instructions, and I'm going to talk about the instructions here a little later in this argument. Two, I argued that they may have made their decision because they were biased or they came in with some preconceived notions. And three, I said the only other way that they could have come in here and found zero damages was if they decided that I hadn't produced any or they rejected all my evidence on damages, which I think under the law they were not entitled to do because it was undisputed and there was lots of it.
Well, we've said in a previous writing, though, that a jury doesn't have to accept evidence, that even if that's the only evidence on a subject, they are the determiners of fact and they can reject or accept it as they see fit in collective wisdom. Would you concede that?
I concede that this court has said that, Your Honor, but I believe I submitted a case to you that indicates that the jury can only reject so much undisputed evidence before it becomes fundamentally unfair and the verdict is against the weight of the evidence and it's unjust. There simply was no evidence to contradict the evidence I submitted on damages. So even if they reject part of it, at some point, the court should have recognized they can no longer reject all of this evidence. It's fundamentally unfair.
What figure did you give the jury in the final argument that they should return on the wrongful death claim, and what figure did you give them that they should return on the survival action?
Your Honor, I don't believe that we gave the jury a number. I think we, again, asked them for what was reasonable and fair.
Follow up on that, what kind of evidence did you have as to specific numbers?
We didn't submit specific numbers as far as there was one mention of a funeral bill, which we would be entitled to, but mostly we went for all of the damages that you can get under the wrongful death statute and under the survival action, personal injuries and loss of society, companionship, advice, so forth, so on.
There was a bill, a funeral bill that was presented?
I believe so. At least it was discussed in front of the jury.
Well, was it admitted or not?
To be honest with Your Honor, I can't remember. It was a year ago, and I don't know for sure, and I don't want to misrepresent anything to the court.
Well, if it's there, it's there.
Page 6 of your reply brief, you set out Haas's attorney argued, and basically it goes, the South Dakota legislature has found that alcoholic beverages, rather than the serving of them, is the proximate cause of the injury inflicted upon another intoxicated person. Now, the reason the court properly ruled that my clients, Alan and Zenda Haas, aren't social host is kind of simple, is they didn't provide the alcohol. Plaintiff does not claim that Mr. and Mrs. Haas furnished the alcohol, so thereafter the social host immunity applies. Now, I think the social host immunity applies that if you think the only thing that went wrong was alcohol was consumed on the Haas place and that it somehow creates liability. Judge Trandall took care of that. South Dakota legislature took care of that. Now, first of all, did you object to his argument there?
Your Honor, I did ask the judge for a hearing at the bench. Did I make a formal objection on the record? No, sir. But I got up and I objected with him present and the judge. I did object to any discussion of the social host issue at all, not only before trial through a motion in limine, but I also made a detailed argument when we were settling instructions about what I thought he would say, and then I contend that he said exactly what I told the judge he was going to say.
Did your opposition argue in defense of the fact, I assume that you were arguing to the jury that Mrs. Haas had a duty of care, basically based on the ordinary law of negligence, and that she failed in that duty? Is that correct?
Well, it's not quite that simple, Your Honor. The judge found that she had voluntarily accepted a duty, and so that the question of whether she had a duty wasn't before the jury. But she told the jury that duty existed, and she needed to act reasonably like a reasonable person would.
All right. Now, did defense counsel argue that she didn't breach that duty in any way?
That's correct.
Or was that covered by this social host immunity language?
He made numerous arguments, Your Honor, to the jury that she acted like a reasonable person would act under the situation, and therefore she hadn't breached the duty. By making the children make a phone call home to their parents, he argued that that's what a reasonable person would have done. With regard to the social host, he was just saying he didn't think that statute applied and that they were immune.
Yeah, but I mean, he's argued it so broadly that it takes care of everything, that Judge Crandall took care of it, that the South Dakota legislature took care of it. But did you argue that that was not applicable to the question of just ordinary negligence on her part?
I argued it in great detail, Your Honor. We had a huge summary judgment motion on that particular issue. The judge agreed with me that statute had no applicability to this case whatsoever because the landowners had not given them any alcohol. And she followed me along with that up until the time we settled instructions, and then she decided, well, I'm going to instruct the jury on what the law is not. And she told them, well, the social host deal does not apply, but here's the law. And then Jack, I believe, turned it around and told the jury that he thought it did apply.
Didn't the trial court do that because the trial court observed that some of the jurors were confused early on in the voir dire, and some of the jurors incorrectly assumed just because the Hossings had liquor there that there might be liability?
That's what she said when we were settling instructions, Your Honor.
Did you observe that to occur? Was there some jury misunderstanding in the voir dire, where some jurors expressed a possible belief that you would be liable automatically if there was alcohol on this farm?
Candidly, I must admit, yes, I did. There was some of the jurors that mentioned that. But I think we addressed it through the other instructions, which specifically stated that the plaintiff is not suing Allen or Zenda Hazi as landowners. And we tried to address it in every respect in the other instructions, and I don't think the social host instruction should have been given.
No, in conjunction with the landowners or the social host instruction, the court also gave a very specific instruction on landowner liability. And didn't the court instruct the jury how they could be held liable for not supervising the gate properly, giving the keys and things like that?
I guess I'm not understanding your question.
Well, there's another jury instruction.
And I objected to that one as well, Your Honor.
But that one specifically instructed the jury the circumstances under which a landowner could be found liable, not for having alcohol on the farm, but for not supervising the party correctly. What that instruction was given, was it not?
There was a landowner. I guess I don't read it that way. I think that she was stating that these particular landowners could not be held liable for having the party on their property. And
well, let me then just make it simpler. The trial court also gave an instruction that explained how they could be held liable for having the party on their property. Correct?
Correct.
There was an instruction given.
Yes. I'm going to ask the court to focus in, if you would, on 15-650-59A, subsections 5 and 6, And this court has interpreted those subsections to mean basically, if there is the inference, and I'm quoting from a case when I say inference, the inference or the conclusion that the jury's verdict was swayed by passion for prejudice or mistake of law, then the trial court can step in and grant a new trial. In light of all the evidence on damages that we presented, I don't know how the jury could have decided that there were no damages and award and fine for all four defendants. And because they only filled out one jury verdict form, that's why I'm here. If they had filled out one for Mr. and Mrs. Hazy and said, we fine for these defendants, as I've indicated in my brief, there's a number of reasons why they probably could have done that.
What would be the passion or prejudice?
I don't know that it can be articulated, Your Honor, but they obviously made up their mind early on that they weren't going to fine for the plaintiff. And I don't know if their passion or prejudice was related to the criminal conviction of Mrs. Hazy prior and thinking that they'd already paid enough, they'd suffered enough, and you're not going to bring back a life. And I guess there's an inference in Mr. Taylor's brief that I should have found all those passions and prejudice during the voir dire system. The problem with that is, one, it's impossible to find all the passions and prejudice during the voir dire. Two, I don't know if those passions and prejudice came up during the trial. Maybe they talked to their neighbor during the trial. Maybe I said something that created the passion and prejudice. I don't know what it was, but it could have occurred after the voir dire, and then there's nothing I could do to cure it. And so the fact of the matter is that they arrived at a verdict that, in my mind, shocks the conscience. And if the court will read the testimony of the grandfather and the mother and tell me that we didn't present undisputed evidence of wrongful death damages, then I would ask the court to read the testimony of the children who watched Kaz Welch die in that vehicle and tell me that I didn't produce evidence that he had personal injuries before his death. And at that point, if the court decides that I didn't produce any damages and the jury's decision was exactly right, then I guess affirm the decision, because my sense of what's fair and what's just is incorrect, because I think we produced evidence of damages.
You made a reference to a criminal conviction of Mrs. Haas. What was she convicted of?
I believe she was given a nolo pros on something related to having a place where alcohol was given to minors, and I don't know the exact name of the conviction.
One last thing on this. If you can't articulate the passion and prejudice that was involved in this jury case, how can we, in a written decision, say that there was such a thing, and as a result, you're entitled to a new trial?
I believe the standard is, Your Honor, that if you look at the verdict and you cannot explain it in any other reasonable way, then you can assume that it was passion or prejudice or mistake of law. Now, when you go back to that instruction, I'm not giving up on that mistake of law. But if you look at all the evidence and you say it's just fundamentally unfair and there's no other reasonable explanation, then you can find it. Now, with regard to the Hazys, there are reasonable explanations why they would have found for them. And the jury probably should have filled out that verdict form if they wanted to find for the Hazys. But they didn't fill out that verdict form. We wouldn't be here today had they. Had they filled out, well.
Your time is expired.
Okay.
Any further questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dealer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen of the court, Mr. Johnson, esteemed clerks, apologize in advance, lawyer without a voice. I think there's ground for an inappropriate joke there, but I think I can get through this 20 minutes all right. I would like to answer a couple of the questions that I think, without any intention, Mr. Johnson wasn't right on point as to Justice Meyer Henry. There was no funeral bill submitted. There was no specific dollar damage evidence submitted against either sets of defendants, the Kleins or the Hazys. The Justice Zinter, there was no objection to the verdict forms, and I believe that the court has those in the record, of course, You can look at the verdict forms. There was four verdicts, one for the plaintiff against the clients, two for the plaintiff against, correction, one for the plaintiff against all defendants, and it was a dollar number. There was then a verdict form that was therefore favorable to the defendant Hazzies. And then there was a third verdict form in without objection that was for all four defendants. There was not a specific verdict form proposed or submitted just for dollar damages against the Hazzies by themselves.
I know you don't represent the clients, but how do you explain how the jury could find in their favor when they admitted liability?
Okay, I'll go right to that, Justice, because it is a difficult explanation, and I'm not here. It's clearly two lawsuits. It's a lawsuit for misconduct driving. They would have had significant defenses, contributory and assumption and so on, but they weren't submitted to the jury against the clients because of their admissions. They were there. Mrs. Klein testified. Darby testified. Emotional, I mean, bosom buddies grew up together and spent their whole high school years on road trips drinking and having fun, and the decedent and Darby Klein are great young men, and unfortunately one died. The longer I practice and the longer I'm in front of South Dakota juries, the more respect I have for them. Not that I've ever had any disrespect, and here's what happened, is two parties declined, had no financial responsibility. So parties, particularly counsel, developed a trial theme. Tried the case for 4 days, and there was just about absolutely no evidence ever entered that pointed to the Kleins by themselves because of the friendship and no financial responsibility. And I pointed it out in our brief to the motion for notwithstanding the verdict and for a new trial, which is why we're here, is that plaintiff was given 70 minutes for final argument. In rebuttal, in his 71st minute, as he lapped over the clock, he said, by the way, you will have to fill out a verdict for the client because there is no issue. That was the only request that counsel made on behalf of the plaintiff for specific damages against the clients. So the respect I have for jurors, if you don't put in funeral bills, as highlighted by one of the justices here, if you don't get up and ask for damages, if you don't even suggest that someone is negligent because they admitted it, and tell the jury why they can enter a judgment in one lawsuit, the Klein lawsuit, and not the Hazzy lawsuit, you're not going to win. At least that day in Winter and Tripp County, South Dakota.
So you're saying, in essence, they waived any claims against them, right? You get faults on both sides?
Well, in fact, when the judge, Judge Trandall, appropriately addressed the verdict forms, the question was asked by me, okay, that verdict that's in favor of all four defendants, how could they find for all four defendants? And she said, well, appropriately, well, they may find that you didn't prove, as the plaintiff, proximately caused damages for the plaintiff against the clients. No objection, and it's sound. I didn't submit that verdict form because I thought, in fact, I argued to the jury on behalf of the plaintiff. There's a verdict over here, and you can fill it out for the plaintiff against the clients. But that doesn't now take us to the second lawsuit, which has to do with a lot with landowner and social host. And as Justice Zinner pointed out, we did voir dire so carefully, I've never been involved in one. After the general voir dire, we took the prospective jurors in one by one with the court reporter, the judge, and all counsel and parties. And we went through extensive questioning through multiple numbers of people to get down to 12, actually 13, because we had an alderman. There was, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, significant confusion in that community. In fact, Mr. Johnson today talked about the Hazzies as landowners. We always, for 4 days in trial, all the way through voir dire, they are the landowners. When we get down to the facts, Mrs. Hazzy didn't volunteer and do all the things that Mr. Johnson said. There were two mothers at the gate. There were dozens of parents. There was into the hundreds of cars. This was one of the very last cars that left. And the only thing that the Ozzies did, never had a child that attended such a party. Their child wasn't all out all week drinking like the other kids in this car that became the fatal mishap. Is they didn't understand this. All the parents were there. In fact, the plaintiff, the decedent's mother, was the one that guarded the bucket all night, sat at the music stand and guarded the key bucket. So there was an informal set of rules. The plaintiff didn't sue all these other parents. In fact, we looked at the post-judgment contribution issue and said, how many people would we sue for joint tortfeasor contribution? If, in fact, the only duty they had, which was properly instructed, they were instructed that there is a duty that may have been breached. And of course, the judge determines duty. We object to the judge's duty relative to the Hazis. But the judge submitted it, and the jury then issued a verdict for the Hazis that said, you didn't prove negligence, or, as Mr. Johnson pointed out in his brief, six possibilities. Or you're contributory negligent, more than slight as the decedent. Factually, there's all kinds of contributory evidence relative to the decedent. Or maybe he assumed a risk. There wasn't any proximately caused damages against the clients. And he gets down to the sixth possibility of, well, maybe there's prejudice, passion, and the verdict shouldn't stand. As to the prejudice and passion, is you have to submit it to the trial court. And we pointed that out in our brief. And the motion, I got it sitting there, is one paragraph, and it says, motion for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict or for a new trial. And it says, I incorporate all the arguments in my brief. And then they went on why the verdict was inconsistent and hard to explain why wasn't there a verdict for the clients, which surprised everybody, obviously, besides the plaintiff. And then against the Hazis, they merely said, they have these gatekeeper duties, and they have these duties relative to the bucket, and they, amongst the dozens and hundreds of parents and aunts and uncles and grandmothers and grandfathers and other adults that ran the band and did everything else and organized the party, that these two individuals, Alan and Zenda, not because they're landowners, not because they provided alcohol, which they didn't, but merely because they happened, one of them happened to be at the gate as they left, one of the very last cars. And so, they didn't submit, and we've said to the court under the 1999 decision of this court, you have to submit that for motion for new trial, judgment notwithstanding the verdict, the grounds for new trial. Those grounds, if it's prejudice and passion, Judge Tranville should have an opportunity to address that. So they basically addressed generally the instruction to the court on which everybody said is the right law. There isn't any social host. They addressed the landowner. They weren't sued because he was hurt on the premises. Typical premise liability, fell in a hole. They weren't sued as that, and the jury needed to be told that. But they were told a gatekeeper and bucket function. If you find they breached it and then wasn't contributory and wasn't assumed and proximately caused, they could award damages. So, and then the court understands on the instructions. You take the instructions as a whole. Are they erroneous as a whole? And they haven't even contended that they are. Well, that's what our court said you have to do in the Bridgewater-Morris decision in 99. Are the instructions as a whole wrong? Second, you have to say, is the one specific instruction wrong? Which is the opposite. Everybody says, that is the law. The law is, I'm not being sued, Mr. and Mrs. Hazi, as a social host or as a landowner. And then you have to point out, even if it was prejudicial and it's not, even if it is a misstatement of the law and it's not, why the verdict may have been different had you not given the instruction. We're back to that pondery, as pointed out this morning, is by Justice Goldenkamp, how can we then read into the just general verdict, prejudice, passion, which wasn't submitted to the trial court, now on appeal, when they start reading their own record, they don't have anything else, so they threw it in.
What did you argue to the jury in relation to the duty of care or the negligence theory as against your client?
Well, one, we argued that they had no way breached it and pointed out how many dozens and literally hundreds of adults and students, the students run the party. And we said that if you find that Zinda, because she happened to be at the gate when one of the last cars at late in the morning, late in the early hours of the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, left. If she breached that, then she could be found negligent, but she didn't. We also argued about the bucket. The bucket, for the most time, was in the hands of other parents, specifically Rhonda Doodle, the decedent's mother. We argued that to the jury that the Mr. Hazy, because he, for some short period of time, was by the bucket, didn't breach a duty. We went on, and then the contributory negligence relative to the non-admitting party was the following. This wasn't a drunk individual who fell asleep on the way to town. He was closer to Winter. They were closer to Winter than they were the party, and it's 40 miles. And he didn't fall asleep. This wasn't a sleepy, in fact, it was horseplay. And so one of the hundreds of cars that left, Mr. and Mrs. Hazy were supposed to foresee that the decedent from the third seat back in a car with little openings between them and the bucket seat cars walked up and started messing with the radio. And Darby Klein said, and then there was someone asked for a cell phone. He turned around and was jostling with the decedent, handing a cell phone back. When he looked up, he was in the ditch. So where was what Mr. and Mrs. Hazy did approximate cause of anything? Where would the slight negligence of the decedent be relative to Mr. and Mrs. Hazy? And then a young gal testified, the cousin's young girl, a classmate of theirs, she was over at the University of South Dakota when we subpoenaed her, and she came in and said, well, yeah, the group of us, we spent 4 years on the road. We drank every weekend. We took road trips. In fact, we were out drinking the whole week of graduation, drinking these kegs of glass bottle. So that's assumption of the risk. The decedent was the one that raised the money, bought the beer along with the others, and got into the car with his buddy that he'd been driving, and it just happened to be that Darby was driving that night rather than the decedent or one of these other young ladies and gentlemen. So alcohol kills. Alcohol probably had absolutely nothing to do with horseplay and ending up in the ditch. So all of those things were submitted. And of course, the Westover case and Nelson v. Nelson Cattle Company are some of the recent pronouncements. Where does negligence belong? Why did we not get summary judgment saying there is no duty? Well, the judge said, well, we're going to define this duty and we're going to give negligence to the jury. We're going to give contributory to the jury. We're going to give assumption to the jury. We're going to give proximate cause to the jury. And then our court has repeatedly appropriately said, we now, particularly against the general verdict, won't jump in the jury box and find against a verdict that is consistent relative to the instructions and consistent relative to the facts to sustain a finding of no liability for Mr. and Mrs. Hazy. So this is two lawsuits. If the court, despite the plaintiff's lack of record against Mrs. Klein and her son Darby, feel that the matter should be retried, and the plaintiff has a horrible record getting to hear for that. So to that extent, I'm vicariously representing the Kleins. You can send that back for a trial, and it would be a damage trial against Mr. Darby Klein and the mother for negligent entrustment because she didn't make any denial. So I think they would have been very defensible. But you can send it back. The judge properly instructed the jury that each defendant is separately treated. That's why we had a verdict form where you could find for the Hazys. And so look at those. The fourth verdict form was an apportionment of fault. And the only interrogatories were then issues relative to the contribution amongst joint tort feasors that they find for against two, three, or four of the defendants. So the record is here. The burdens are totally on the plaintiff. The standard of review, we read the standard review for a JNOV. The standard of review for a new trial. The standard of review in order to overturn a verdict based on an alleged misinstruction. You always go back to the soundness of the trial court. And Judge Tranville was there from Vordire to the end. She heard it all. and you just go in there and you, under that standard of review, you can't send this back to trial against Mr. and Mrs. Hosmer. It would be kind of overturning all the negligence and contributory, all the affirmative defenses in the negligence cases upside down in South Dakota to say, based on these facts, and a jury that was properly instructed that found that Mr. and Mrs. Hosmer didn't violate a duty or the affirmative defenses. We have to peel open that general verdict and wildly speculate on a grounds that was never submitted to the trial court. I was going to end up my time here by saying that Justice Kornkamp properly asked me the question, why would that verdict not be issued? So all I can say is procedurally, plaintiff had their day in court against all defendants. Procedurally, you could send them back against the two Klein defendants. But procedurally, standard of review, factually, and all the law, you can't send Mr. and Mrs. Hosmer back. And if you, with your judicial minds, because of the effect of negligence law, can you imagine if Mr. and Mrs. Klein violated some duty? Why didn't they sue the other lady at the gate? Why didn't they sue the other parents on the bucket? Why didn't they sue? What, sue the school? Because they knew about it. There were teachers there. There were people representing every facet of the community there. And actually, they didn't run the party. The students did. They had a 21-year-old DJ, and it was a student-run party that went afoul because of horseplay in a ditch. And it was tragic. A great young man lost his life. But it has nothing to do with any duty, breach of duty, of Zenda or Alan Hosmer. Any other questions?
Thank you. Nobody's chastened or whatever.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Thieler asked, well, why didn't we sue all those other parents? And why didn't we sue everybody else that was at that party? First of all, he had the option to bring them in, too, if he thought they were partly responsible. Second of all, none of those other parents were there guarding the gate, except the one other one, and I'll get to her in a second, and none of those other parents had control of the keys at the time Darby Klein drove out. Now, if one of the other parents had been in control of the keys earlier in the night, and Darby had left earlier in the night, somehow got his keys from her, that's who we would have sued. Now, with regard to the other person at the gate, that person, to my knowledge, didn't talk to Darby Klein, wasn't the one that asked him to call his parents, wasn't the one that opened the gate, wasn't in control of the gate. That's why we didn't sue her. And so, I guess that's all I have to say about that. Now, there's been arguments about what was going on right prior to the accident. I have no offense to Mr. Thieler, but I think that was a gross misstatement of what the actual testimony was at trial. I don't think that there was any jostling around with the driver. I believe the testimony was that he went and my client went and changed the radio like some reasonable kids would do when they're in a car. And then he was going back, and at that time someone in the back asked for the phone, and the driver turned around to throw the phone back, and that's when he lost control. Now, I don't know what exactly or what risk exactly my client assumed when he got in that car. We've never discussed that. Did he assume that the driver was going to turn around and throw a phone to the back of the car and then go in the ditch and then hit an approach and then land up on its side? No, I don't know that he did knowingly assume that risk. And so...
Well, didn't he assume if he had been partying in this van with this driver on numerous occasions drinking beer, and isn't that some evidence of assumption of the risk? As well as the fact, as I understand the record, apparently they loaded this van up with beer, including a keg, when they left. Isn't that some evidence of assumption of the risk?
It is some evidence of assumption of the risk, but as I understand the law, Your Honor, you have to specifically identify which exact risk he was assuming, and he has to knowingly and intelligently assume it. Now, I don't know which risk. Did he risk, take a chance by getting in the car? Yes, he did. but a chance of 1,000 different things. The defendants never came forward and said exactly what risk he assumed. No one.
Assume the risk of death or serious injury, isn't that just a given?
Not always, Your Honor. I believe the standard in South Dakota is that if you can tell that the person is noticeably drunk and you're in a position to make a knowing and intelligent decision about whether he's to be safe to ride with, then yes, I think you have an obligation not to get in that car, duty. Now, my client had been up all night long too and had been doing some drinking. I don't know what he perceived, and there's no evidence in the record about whether Darby Klein was stumbling around when he got in that car and when they loaded the keg. So I don't know exactly what he knew when he got in that car.
Did you say it was a .07 blood test or point?
Or .187.
So he's almost twice over the legal limit.
Yes, sir.
This is the driver's?
What's that?
That was the driver's test?
Yes, sir. And, of course, that was had to be redacted back by our expert, but that was his estimate.
Did they do a drug test, a blood alcohol content test also on your client?
I believe they did as part of the autopsy. And to your next question, I don't remember what his alcohol content was.
Was it over 0.10? Do you remember that?
I don't think it was.
Is it in the record?
I believe so. I believe the autopsy reports were submitted to the jury, or were put in there. Mr. Thieler asked, well, were his clients supposed to perceive this wreck because of all these other cars going out there? Well, he did. He said it himself, alcohol kills. When you've got a bunch of high schoolers drinking and partying all night long, and they come up to a gate and they're getting ready to drive out of there, and they've got a keg of beer in the back, yeah, at some point, you start foreseeing that maybe bad things could happen, particularly if there's that many cars leaving. One of them is probably going to get in a wreck. And so his argument that it was unforeseeable that this was going to happen, I guess it defies logic in my mind. Mr. Thieler mentioned that we didn't argue a lot during closing argument about what the clients had done wrong and what their whole position in this matter was. Part of that was because he'd done such a great job for us, pointing the finger at the clients that we didn't figure we needed to spend our time on. The second reason was they had admitted liability and causation, and so we didn't feel like they were instructed. The only thing they needed to decide was how much damages there were. And so we didn't feel like we had to retrace the whole thing and prove that they were liable again, and so we didn't have to spend a lot of time on it.
Did the clients participate in the final argument?
No, sir, they did not. They participated as witnesses, and they were examined in great length and made admissions throughout. I mean, they were very candid in their testimony.
Did the court instruct the jury or direct the jury that the clients have defaulted in their answers, and then therefore that all they have to do is determine a reasonable amount of damages?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe it was instruction number 21, and it said just that. They have
included proximate, so it got past the point of proximate cause, and it just went. They were instructed to return a verdict for the proper amount of damages.
I believe the language was that they, and this first part is not a quote, that they had admitted liability, but their only responsibility towards the clients was to assess how much damages, if any, had been produced. And that last part is a quote from the instruction. And so there was no, and Judge Trandall said that, well, maybe they didn't find it, that they proximately caused the injury. That wasn't before them. And so if the jury had found that, then that's a mistake of law, and that's grounds for a new trial.
But it is still possible, as Mr. Thieler says, that the jury could have found that it's actually contributory negligence and substantive arrest since they defaulted or since they didn't answer. Those aren't questions that are those questions that the jury should consider in relation to damage.
Well, we made it pretty clear in the instructions, Your Honor, and I don't know the exact one, but we made it clear that those defenses had no application towards the Kleins whatsoever. And so I think it was clear to them that they weren't supposed to think about those things when they were trying to assess damages for the Kleins.
Kleins didn't even answer, did they? Did they file an answer at all?
No.
So they didn't raise contributory negligence or assumption of the risk or anything by their pleadings?
No.
Did the jury still have to find whether there was proximate cause for the Kleins? Was that an issue for the jury, or had that also been conceded?
It had been conceded because they defaulted on our complaint, which alleged that they had been the proximate cause of the damages, of the wrongful death and the survival damages. So when they defaulted, they admitted those allegations as well. That's what the instruction said.
You're inside 2 minutes.
I'm in, excuse me, Your Honor?
You're inside of 2 minutes.
With regard to Mr. Taylor's argument about, well, the jury may have found contributory negligence with regard to the Hazzies. They may have found assumption of the risk. Those are true, and I've addressed that in my brief. They may have found those things, but they may have also found no damages for the same reason they found no damages against the clients. And we just simply cannot know because they filled out that one form.
In the absence of a special interrogatory, we can't guess at it either, can we?
No, you cannot.
So don't you have to prove to us that, don't you have to have a special interrogatory in there that shows that, that they did not find assumption of risk contributory negligence?
I think that that would be exactly the case, Your Honor, had they only been the only two defendants in here, or had they filled out the verdict form for just these two defendants. I would have no argument against the Hazzies if they had filled out one of the instructions or the jury form just for the Hazzies.
So you think we can assume that because at least you argue a mistake was made over here, that it also had to be made over here?
I think you have to assume that, Your Honor, because how can you possibly know whether they were acting under passion or prejudice and mistake of law just towards the Kleins, and then on with regard to the Hazzies, they were using full faculties and decide the case just on the law? There is absolutely no way to know that because they filled out that one verdict form.
Your time has expired, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.